But before that, honorable members, we have in our list Ms. Danielle Tata, a doctoral candidate from the Michigan State University, who is doing her thesis on matters related to security, and she has humbly requested to interview some members of the committee. I hope members who she requested to receive the SMS yesterday. If not so, she wanted to meet Mr. Watson, Mr. Mahori, Mr. Makubela, myself, and Mr. Zimande. I don't know how long the meeting is going to take, but if members can arrange and just have time, maybe 30 minutes, we say, and then come back so that you continue with the business of the day. In the meantime, Patricia, can you take her to Nzwaki in the office? No, no, not now. Can members introduce themselves?
Thank you, Chair. Morning. I'm John Gunda. I'm a member of this committee, and I'm a permanent delegate to the NCOP.
Morning. My name is Tunka Matila, a member of this committee, representing the Gauteng province.
Good morning. My name is Lewin Zimande from KwaZulu-Natal. I am a member of this select committee and, of course, part of the ruling party, member of the ruling party. Thanks.
Good morning, colleagues. My name is Wati Watson. I'm a delegate from the province of Mpumalanga, where the sun rises. And if it doesn't rise, then you're all in the dark. And I represent the Democratic Alliance. In fact, I'm the leader of the official opposition in the NCOP.
I'm Theo Bielefeld. I'm a permanent delegate to the NCOP. I am representing the ruling party of the Western Cape, the DA, and I'm also the whip. Thank you.
With me on my right, we have the support staff. He is the secretary of the committee, Mr. Gershwin Dixon, and the lady who went out there is this the researcher of the committee, Patricia Whitler. You can introduce us. Thank you. Morning.
My name is Haikela Joni Akai, leader of the delegation from Parliament of the Republic of Namibia, and I'm representing the Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defense and Security of the National Council of the Parliament of Namibia.
Can you get that name again?
Haikela John Hakaye.
All right.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Honorable Bartholomew Shangheta, a Vice Chairperson of the Standing Committee on Regional Development and Reports. And now I'm a member of this select committee.
Thank you. I am Henok Kankoshi, a member of the National Council Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defense and Security, and also a member of the National Council, the second House of Parliament in Namibia.
Thank you very much. My name is Martin Ara, a member of Parliament, National Council, Republic of Namibia.
Good morning. My name is Bragias Nomandi. I am member of Foreign Affairs, Defense and Security Committee and member of National Council, Parliament of Namibia.
Good morning. My name is Sivalatani Bernard. I'm a member of Parliament, National Council. Thank you.
Good the remainders, my name is Mara Bessner, clerk to the Committee on Regional Development.
Morning. My name is Amalia Ita. I'm a committee clerk to the Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defense and Security.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Zingisa Tawe. I'm with the International Relations Section of Parliament of the Republic of South Africa. I'm the one who's facilitating these kinds of meetings for parliamentarians to meet with other parliamentarians. Thank you very much.
The lady at the back.
Good morning, my name is Johanna Boysen. I'm from PMG.
There's another gentleman who has just joined us. Can he also introduce himself?
Thank you, Chair. My name is Matome Havrum Hori, member of the committee.
Honorable members, the items as reflected on the agenda deals with the role of committee in dealing with the defense and security affairs, the international obligations, national security and foreign policy, the influence of the select committee in defense-related matters, and lastly, the executive and ministerial accountability to Parliament. I'm not sure what kind of the discussion or how should the discussion ensue. Except to say that from our side, as the select committee, Parliament consists of two houses, the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces. We are the National Council of Provinces. We represent the nine provinces, which forms the whole of the country. We are permanent delegates in the NCOP. And our role mainly is to do oversight and monitoring over the departments. The committees, the departments in the NCOP are clustered, and ourselves as the Select Committee on Security and Constitutional Development, we exercise monitoring over the Department of Justice, Department of Correctional Services, Police and Defense and Military Veterans. They will come time to time and give their annual reports on their performance, and we interact with those annual reports, and we do oversight visits to various departments and those institutions that fall under them. That is briefly our mandate, and I think I will hand over to honorable members to further deliberate on the engagements. And if there is anything you would want to ask, you can just indicate so that I hand over to you. And you raise those issues that you want to raise. Honorable Matila.
Yeah, Chair, maybe just to indicate that most of the daily work around committees, particularly around defense, because defense is not a provincial competence, it's a national competence, that work falls under the portfolio committee in the National Assembly. But anything else that comes out of the report, we do oversight on. You know, if in terms of the budget that was allocated to the Defence Committee, when we look at what the Auditor General raises there, we're able to can then call the Defence Department and then say, no, what is happening here? Yeah. But in terms, that's why all bills that comes through about defense, they are called 75 bills, which means they are national bills. But those bills will come to the upper house, which is the NCOP, for rectification. If we disagree with that bill, we'll send that bill back. You know, that means this is the house that represents the interests of the provinces, and that is the process. Mainly, our main focus will be on issues that are dealing with areas where, which affects provinces directly in most cases, like police, because those are issues that affect communities on the ground. Now, those are issues that on a daily basis we'll be dealing with. But in terms of defense, like today, the defense committee is coming to brief us on a specific bill, which is the 75 bill, which we need to go through it. If we disagree, that bill won't go through. If we agree, the bill will go through. You know, that's how we, I think, we operate. Thank you.
Anything else from honorable members? Any question from the side?
Not question yet, but I think we to allow maybe our deliberation to proceed is also to elaborate a little bit on what we are seeking for. We are more or less, especially we are two committees in one now, Committee on Regional Development and Reports, and the Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defense and Security that I'm a chair. And in Namibia too, our role is more or less the same. We are overseeing the departments or ministries that have to do with the security sector of the nation, namely defense, safety and security, that's that of the police, for home affairs and migration, foreign affairs as well, because foreign affairs have got to do with also our foreign policy in terms of security and all that, correctional services, and the newly established Ministry of Veteran Affairs also fall under our committee. And we do go out and support and oversight and also examine the apparatus of the defense securities countrywide. As you may be aware that Namibia had no government of its own before independence. The police and defense that was there was not ours. Then the one that we have established is from almost zero square, and a lot of budget and engagement is required, whereby at national, maybe not that a priority, but you talk no country with development if the security is at stake or something. So these are some of the things that we are engaged between the central government, parliament, and line ministries or people assigned to there. Ours, therefore, coming here is to see how committee of parliament engage with the or overseeing or carrying out their oversight functions towards this, and what is it that they are doing, maybe that we can draw examples from or lessons from and apply it in our country, and if at all our counterpart is equally interested in our situation, we can also answer questions where we are able to. If not, then we do not, because security questions sometimes demands those are more or less at well placed. But in other words, we are here to learn from your experience on how you oversight this apparatus of the state in terms of providing security, law and order, and all other things in your country. I think that will make us understand our reason why we are here. Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Yes, you raise your hand up. Okay. What normally happens? when the term starts, the committee agrees on a program, a quarterly program, that it draws and approves on the meetings and the interactions with the departments and the areas that we would like to visit. And sometimes our visit to institutions that fall under the select committee are unannounced visits, depending on the issue that has occurred. Like, for instance, in the correctional services, there was in one of the prisons a situation where the inmates were not satisfied and they burned the facility. It is our responsibility to know the reasons that led to that situation. In some instances, you will find that when police are busy combating crimes, we have the Bill of Rights that guarantees the life of every citizen. And the responsibility of the police is to combat crime. And in the process, they happen to be involved with criminal activities, especially in cash in transits, where those criminals will be armed and they shoot and kill police. And in defense, police will also shoot and kill those criminals. But it is a criminal offense in our country to kill a person, no matter the circumstances. Even that conduct of police is not allowed. We have what we call the Investigative Criminal Directorate. It is an independent body that investigates the conduct of police. Where police have misbehaved or there is a corruption within their ranks, it is that body that that ensures that the conduct of police in combating crime is in line with what the Constitution stipulates. Also in the correctional services, is the department and the what is called the parole board. The role of the parole board is to deal with the parole of the inmates who have served a minimum sentence and are eligible for release. The consent inmates will make an application to the board, and the board will deal with the merit of the application and recommend to the minister the release or the continued incarceration of the inmate. Honorable Nzimande.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think in addition to the activities and the business of this select committee, Chair, one would highlight that the issue of, you see, we fall under the peace and security cluster. We've clustered departments. For instance, you'd have economics cluster where you have a whole host of committees. And this one is a criminal and justice cluster, because it is in our view that security and justice goes together, because in any case you have to still handle those people that cause insecurity to to other citizens. You still have to handle them either through rehabilitation and sanctioning of their misconduct that causes security problems to the citizens in the country. And for instance, we're working with in the justice area, we're working with the Magistrate Commission, for instance, which is an independent body that handles the issues of magistrates. But we do have a role to play, oversight role as well, in collaboration with the Magistrate Commission in handling and also doing further guidance on issues of conduct by magistrates and various issues of service delivery in relation to the access to justice by the citizens. So we handle that area in full. As the chairperson was just saying as well, we're working now, we're proposing to change the name now of the Independent Complaints Directorate, which was the guys that were policing the police on how much they on their conduct besides the internal disciplinary mechanisms and structures of within the police itself. We then have emanating from the Constitution this independent body that looks into the conduct of the police and proper functioning of the police and appropriate responses of the police, you know, amongst themselves or to the citizens. And we currently processing a bill that is looking into changing the focus of this body into investigations, because from the experience we've seen that we were complaints driven, but we feel now that the part of investigations into the police conduct when they're doing their job, their work, has presented with situations that require a lot of investigations and a lot of action to be taken, so that police are always working impartially and fair in handling and responding to people who would be alleged criminals, and perhaps even people that are vulnerable, not just criminals, but people who are vulnerable, whether, you know, it's just a question of a domestic violence. They come in there, they find an angry man beating the wife, and they would respond sometimes very harsh to the guy, so all sorts of behaviors that might be questionable in terms of what is expected of a police supposed to provide security and go beyond what the mandate is of providing security and protection to the citizens. And also in relation to, you know, the custody of those people that are then sentenced or unsentenced, we're looking at the collaboration of departments as well, you know, with the police, the correctional services, the justice, in making sure that the process of providing service to citizens from being from being taken into, by the police, or arrested, detained and arrested by the police, into processing justice, into sanctions that are then handed down by the courts, that everything is done, in recognition of the rights that the person would have granted by the Constitution as such. So therefore, we quite critical in monitoring and harmonizing and encouraging that these departments collaborate in making sure that the rights are not violated by the state itself in trying to deal on one hand with somebody who is alleged criminal and somebody who is already sentenced and somebody who is supposed to dispense justice. You know, all of these things need to be harmonized and made to work together. So a part of our work also is to look into the welfare of those that are in captive or in correctional services, as we call it, and looking at the department, you know, adhering to those things that forms fundamentally the mandate of, for instance, correctional services, where they have to allocate funds to rehabilitate the prisoners and offences. We're looking at the justice system. I think this year we've just put in the Child Justice Act. It started to work now, where we are able to handle the young offenders, because there's been we're one of the countries that has had a very high children awaiting trial, children and children that are in prisons. And so it becomes, important that these security state departments work together. We streamline and harmonize their work, their functioning together in providing this service, this part of service delivery, you know, of justice and security. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Kunda?
Yes, Chair. Yeah, something else. What's important to this committee is we take our oversight role very crucial. It's a very crucial role. And in oversight, we're not only doing oversight for the purpose of doing oversight. We can also make recommendations to the department concerning certain issues that we are not pleased with when we do our oversight work. The executive, the department, are accountable to this committee because we represent the people of the provinces, and we speak on behalf of the people of the provinces. That's why we are permanent delegates from certain provinces. And what's very important for us when we're doing oversight is that we look to the things that has been budgeted for, how they spend the money, and we ask crucial questions concerning how the money has been spent, and we also talk to them concerning service delivery, concerning, as my colleague has just said, we are also concerned about the state, where the status of the prisons, the police cells, whatever, what concerning security. And we really look for, when we go out on oversight, we are not looking to punish the department, no. Our main aim is to see where they can do the work better, how they can apply concerning the financial things like that. The PFMA, we've got control by a PFMA system, the Public Funds Management Act, and that's actually our main role thing. And then we bring issues as a committee. When we're doing our constituency work, we can bring issues as a committee that, like sometimes I can phone the chairperson and say, listen, I've picked up something in this province here, in this town, concerning how the police are treating some people, or I've picked up this here. And then we go in and investigate those allegations and see if it's true or if it's just allegations and all that. But the committee itself is doing a lot of work concerning seeing to it that the money of our taxpayers of this country, it's been spent wisely. We make it a point, and when we have the annual reports of the departments coming to us, we ask them questions on certain issues that you have not done properly. Why is it like that? Why, for instance, if they've got a high vacancy rate, like they don't have an HOD, or they have an acting HOD for more than a year or 9 months. Why is it like that? Why do you have an acting DDG? We ask those types of questions because we want to know what's happening in the department, because our purpose is to see to it that the department must run smoothly and properly. That's our one of our other functions. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Matila.
Yeah, Chair, I think the main area is around, because a department, for example, like defense, at the beginning of the financial year will come and say, we need so much to do 1, 2, 3, you know. When we then hold them accountable for that but specific purpose. If they did not do that, you know, we then make sure that, you know, we ask them as to whether, why was this not done? What are the problems? You know, they need to explain as to what are their own problems. But, you know, the main issue is to hold the department accountable for what they have requested from Parliament. You see, because they, you can't give them money if they don't have a program for that specific purpose. You see, that's one of the areas. Yeah, but also, if a department does not want to account, you know, if a person does not want to come, we have powers to subpoena that person as a committee. In terms of the acts that they are referring to, there are specific sanctions. If a person misleads Parliament, there are specific sanctions. We can recommend that this person goes to jail for a maximum of 2 years. You know, there are those areas that are there in terms of making sure that we hold departments and individuals within those departments, because there are people that must, the CFO, the head of department, the accounting officers, accountable to Parliament. Thank you.
Anything else from the side? Honourable member?
Thank you very much, Chair. Mine, I just wanted to find out. In many countries like Namibia, security officials or security members are not members of unions. I don't know here in South Africa. Are they members of unions?
Yes. The police and correctional services belong to the union, and also the army. But after the previous strikes, which mainly participants were people who offer essential services, it was recommended that those people who offer essential services should not belong to unions, especially in the army. Honorable Matina, I've noted you, Honorable Matina.
Yeah, no, Chair, for example, SAPS, Correctional Services, Justice, have unions. The union within the army is not a recognized union, because at this stage, you know, they are there, we know, but it has never been recognized by the state, because the state believes that you can't have a union in the army, because that country will have chaos. Yes. Yeah.
Not remember.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Mine, I want to know whether you have been also facing a problem with your army buses or barracks, or the police barracks, if they are also complaining about those things, or what do you have, kind of, how do you achieve to, if you, they are don't have, how do you achieve in order to accommodate them, provide them enough accommodation?
I think initially, immediately after the elections, there were problems, because we had to mesh the liberation forces with the then apartheid force, and there was resistance. Initially, there was resistance. Most of the liberation soldiers complained that they are being ill-treated, and in some instances, in some military bases, there were situations where there was a shootout. Some dissatisfied liberation soldiers went out on a shooting spree and killed former apartheid forces, and the investigations indicated that it was due to resistance from the former apartheid forces to integrate with the former liberation forces. But with time and intervention from the leadership, some of the things were dealt with. Honorable Matila, Honorable Nzimande.
Yeah. Chair, in terms of the police, we don't have barracks. They stay, they are like civilians, you know, they stay at their homes with their families amongst communities. The majority, because there are specific areas, but in terms of what is happening now in the country, in the major cities, you won't find the police in barracks. There were barracks previously. They were staying in compounds and all those things. In terms of the army, as my chair has indicated, unfortunately, you had the former apartheid force, which is the, and then you had the liberation movements. But we also have another problem, where you had homeland forces. You see? Now you had to match all of them. In South Africa, you had about five of them. You see? Now, where you had homeland forces, you had the army, you had the liberation movements, and also there too, you had about three, you see, different forces, which was Now, you must understand the complexity. When they came in, most of the liberation forces were given the lowest ranks, which was the lowest paid. And what was worse to that particular situation was that the ruling party forces were the ones that were the most affected. And you must understand the struggle there. Also, because liberation forces were coming into this particular barracks where they were staying, there were no proper resources given to them. You know, some of the necessary services that are supposed to be given to them, like food, proper water, and all those things, you know, those things were no longer happening, which were our problems. Even to date, the minister has to deal with some of the issues. This is dealing with some of the issues precisely because of the conditions that they find themselves in, which is a struggle. You see? That is one area around the barracks and that. But what the country is trying to do at the end of the day is to make sure that the police force become part of those particular communities so that they can work with communities to combat crime. Because if you isolate them, the difficulty of them finding information within communities is a problem, you see. And that's what we are working towards, making sure that at the end of the day, we eradicate all these barracks, the forces, police forces are amongst the people, so that they move with the people to deal with all those issues around policing and making sure that these communities are safe.
Thanks, Chair. Oh, just a moment, Louis. Sorry for that, please, Honorable Chair. How do you collect these people if there is a problem? If the force is not together, it is also cost some time. in order to get them on time, if there is a agency.
You see, Chair, the army is in barracks. With the army, they are in barracks. Of course, when we visited some of the facilities, and the other committee, defense committee, also visited the facilities, we, as you probably picked up from the news, also the conditions of the barracks are in a not so good state. You know, so one of the things that the minister, for instance, is proposing is a commission that looks into the whole welfare and of the army as such, including remuneration, including facilities that they are using, not just weapons and the modernization of the weapon and all that, but we're also looking at now seriously looking at the welfare of the army and from the remuneration benefits and the facility that keeps them, the kind of training that they require. But with the police, they have access to the vehicles. They are being picked up in the morning from their homes into the police station that they're working on, and so I'm sure the state is spending a lot on petrol transporting the members of the police force from homes or the areas of their living into where they are needed as such, and obviously. We are station based. We're more police station based, more than force based in our work. What I mean by that is that we localized the police station work as part of that community, so to speak, and it's demarcated to work for that area, and therefore the allocation of the vehicles. And the numbers of the police, police members to serve that population, or the community of people in the community, is determined in terms of the resource guide, the resources guide. We've got something called I think it's a resource guide, Che, if I remember correct, which determines. In terms of the per police station, you need so much vehicles, you need so much police numbers for that, given the stats, the crime stats of that area. So that informs the manner in which then you have to determine the kind of services and that you do have units. And what we've focused on is also, you know, trying to beef up the area of the frontline service of the police, where communities are able to walk into the police station, lay a complaint and all that. So it really is a question of integrating the police with the communities, and that's why we have also the community, what we call community policing forum. The community policing forums are members of the community that assist to guide the police on a number of issues, the services that the people want, areas, hotspot areas, and of course there are complaints about the turnaround or the response time. With the police, there is that complaint that the response time of the police, whether it's your emergency, which we call 10111, there are problems in terms of vehicles broken down, and we're facing a lot of problems in getting the police managing the facilities, particularly vehicles. They are broken. They are in accidents. They are. Sometimes somebody runs a spaza shop and uses a police van to go and stock things, you know. So it does happen, but it's matters that we're handling with the community policing forum, with the managers of the police as well as the members of parliament, constituency offices, so that we do monitoring and guide the police to the right behavior. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Matila.
Just responding direct to the question that has been placed. Chair, what we have is that if you check in all our localities, in every shift you have enough police manning an area in a police station. But we also have units in specific areas around for response, for emergency responses and all that, you see. But if you look at, and also you have police that are on standby, even when they are at home for any emergency, and they stay around police stations. They don't stay far from police stations. They don't stay like something like 100 kids away from a police station. No, they are localized. Now, we have all those. That's why we can respond any, you know, if an emergency is there, we respond immediately. People get surprised as to when do they hear that, what has happened quickly. And that's how. But because they are located within a community, it is easy for them to get suspects. If there's an emergency, communities will immediately indicate that this is the situation. Because if they were separated, you know, then there will be them and us. And we're avoiding this them and us situation. Now, they feel free to can move around in those specific communities. Thank you, Chair.
I would like just to know from you that how do you conducting your public hearing when you want maybe to solicit some ideas from the community members regarding maybe the certain security issues that you want maybe to hear from the community. Secondly, on the defense, I know defense is consists various personals, men and women, and some are even married, and sometimes in this world, we have HIV/AIDS epidemic that is killing the people, and maybe to when it comes to the army now, how do you keep couples together in order to avoid maybe this? Because if you separate them, it might, maybe if he's, a man is far from his wife, or he might be indulging in some activities. Thank you.
Honorable Kunda. Okay, let me just answer the question on the public hearings. On the separation of husband and wife, I don't think I've got an answer for that. I don't think we are the people to answer that question, but if any of the members want an answer, they can answer, but I don't. On our public hearings, we inform the community before we arrived what we are going to talk about. If there's a bill concerns the community, the public, we let them know exactly what's happening. In some cases, if people are far from it, we even provide transport to bring them to the meetings, so that they can speak their mind. And whenever we had a 76 bill where the people must give their inputs and the recommendations, when we come to a committee meeting, we bring all the public hearings from the different areas and the recommendations. We make them one piece of recommendation. Then we speak. We deliberate on it as a committee on the issues, how the people see the bill, what the people really want, what the people expect from the bill and all that. And when after deliberations, the provinces also, they are the ones, and then we go out with them to have public hearings. Then the provinces also give us a final mandate that we support the bill, we don't support the bill, but we there was never a time, in few cases where if the bill was not, we've got a six-week cycle that we give enough time to debate the bill without an outside and to get public input and all that. And then we deliberate and we get a final mandate and then we put it through the House with consideration of the recommendations and the inputs of the public. We don't do a 76 bill without the input of the public, the recommendations of the public. That's very important. Otherwise, the bill can't go through. It will go to court. The court said, now you did not do the right procedures and all that. And that's how we do it concerning getting the people involved. That's why you'll always hear the slogan in South Africa, it is the people's government. You'll always hear that slogan because that's how we get the people involved. The NCOP is twice a year is having this program, taking Parliament to the people. Now, this year we are heading for that in Putatichawa in the Free State from the 15th of November up until the 19th. And the last day of the taking Parliament to the people is always been dressed by the first one in the year is the Deputy President. The last one in the year, the second one in the year, is the President who address the NCOP outside, not in Parliament, outside where we are. Normally we're having a big tent, we are normally outside on fields and all that, but we are in the midst of the community. Taking Parliament to the people means you go to the community. That's why we as members, we prepare us twice a year for a week. There's no more luxury. You go there, you see how the people are living, you do the things for the people. That's what we do in that. Thank you, Chair.
In addition to that, I've noted you, Honorable Matila, we are also allocated constituency offices as public representatives. We have what is called the Constituency Day, where every member has to go to his constituency and interact with the community members. We also belong to different political parties. We are required by our parties to call meetings with the people to hear their views regarding issues that affect their lives. Honorable Matila.
Maybe just direct on public hearings. Usually what happens is if we know that we're going to have public hearings, provinces and local government structures will then be informed to mobilize communities to go to where the public was. They would organize that public hearing so that we then go with those structures to those communities to go and listen on a specific issue. If there's a bill, if there's an issue that we must deal with, then we go there. We're coming from different provinces. Now we will go, in terms of our provinces, go to those specific areas, listen, and then come back to Parliament and then report. If there is a need to call other stakeholders to Parliament, you know, usually the National Assembly will call a public hearing in Parliament. That's what we do. But our duty is to go out to communities there and then hold public hearings and then take. What then happens is those provinces will then write a report that comes to Parliament. But you have been there. You also write a report around what has taken place, what are the issues there. And that's how we conduct our public hearing. That's the last thing on defense, on the issue around this issue that you said. Yeah. In terms of our own barracks and whatever, you have what you call single quarters and family units in the same barracks, you see. Because what you then have is where there are single people, they'll stay in the single quarters. Where there are families, those families will be part of, you know, it's like a family area of the military. Because nobody outside the military will stay in those family units, and that's what you have. But you also have those military people who are not on duty or on call there, who will then stay with their families at their homes, you know, permanent, until they are called in for a specific period to go and do a specific duty. But they will then go to work, commute from home to work on a daily basis with a mixture of a process. That's the situation.
Honorable Matila, can you also, on behalf of the committee, send the delegation, because it has been brought to my attention that the other select committee is waiting to interact with them.
No, thank you, Chair. Yeah, no, on behalf of the select committee, we would want to thank you and for having visited us. We hope you have learned something from us. We also hope that in future we'll also learn something from yourselves as a committee. And we know the chair might arrange that we visit you and learn, but also would like you to understand and know our beautiful country. You know, you're part of the southern part of Africa, and this Africa is a beautiful country. In Cape Town, what he has just indicated, that there are specific points that you need to visit. You'll see the beauty of the country, the beauty of Africa, everything is there. We want to wish you well and hope that going back home, you will raise the South African flag and say, you know, we have been to our brothers, we have seen what they are doing, and we hope they'll make sure that Africa thrives. Thank you.
Any comments?
Thank you very much, Chair. I would also like to make use of this opportunity to thank you most sincerely for being availing time to share your experience with us. I want also to make use of this opportunity that security cannot be exclusively for one country in today's world, especially in SADC world. Start with SADC, neighboring countries, South Africa and Namibia, of which you are already tied together by the history that we have been sharing, being of that colonialization, or during the struggle, we fought together. And in this regard, I think what affects South Africa or Namibia, one country eventually will touch the other country's security. It's only by way of exchanging of this nature, especially on parliamentary level and security sector. I know they are meeting, but sometimes when they meet in this world they call joint security commissions and all that, sometimes they don't stay with the members of parliament, which is not held, and sometimes they do not involve them. And when we are at parliament and they meet there, there's a lot that we need to bridge together so that at least at parliament, when we discuss on the issues of security, we discuss on the point of well informed, and we can well be informed when we have the all relevant information. I want also to thank South Africa for having successfully organized and hosted the World Cup, and the security was taught, and has therefore, as you rightly say, that raised not only the South African flag, but proved to the rest of the world that Africa can provide leadership in many areas, including security. Thank you very much for that, and I think we will have a long way to go and say, so that our sub-region will be insecure forever for our children and ourselves and the generations to come. I thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Thank you.
How about Sefero? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, gentlemen. Honorable members, can we continue with the meeting? Honorable members, we are going to deal with the briefing on the Defense Amendment Bill. And before I hand over to the head of the delegation, my name is Chetha Mofokeng. I'm the chairperson of the Select Committee on Security and Constitutional Development. I'll allow honorable members to introduce themselves and then the head of the delegation to introduce his team.
My name is Matome Humphrey Mokgobe, a member of the committee. Matome Humphrey Mokgobe.
My name is John Gunda. I'm a member of this committee, and I'm from the Northern Cape.
Tunga Matila, a member of the committee.
Louis Zemande, excuse me, from KwaZulu-Natal, Peter Maritzburg.
I'm Theo Butterfield, I'm a member of the committee, and I'm representing the Western Cape.
My name is Herman Smith. I'm from the State Law Advisors. My colleague, Kwesa Mongaveli, attended to this bill. He can't be here, but I'm standing in his place.
My name is Tabiso
Ratsumu. I work in the office of the Minister of Defense and Military Veterans.
and responsible for liaison with the committee.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Commander Sweya. I'm from Department of Defense. I'm responsible for labor relations.
Thank you very much, Chair. My name is Viwa Njigela from the Department of Defense Legal Division.
I'm Major Mashiro, Department of Defense, Legislative Drafting.
You can continue the presentation.
Mr. Njigela from the Legal Services will do the presentation.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity to present the bill to you. I understand that copies of the presentation have already been circulated to the members. Unfortunately, we will not be having the overhead thingy, so we will be speaking from the presentation that is before the honorable members. May I proceed, Chair?
Yes.
Chair, starting with the aim of the briefing, obviously, the purpose is to brief the Select Committee on the Defense Amendment Bill. We intend to deal with three aspects of this bill. The bill, firstly, Chair, deals with the creation of an obligation to serve for members of the Reserve Force. Secondly, it proposes an establishment of the Defense Force Service Commission. And thirdly, Chair, we attempt to define what we refer to as military command. I will expand on these different issues as we proceed with the presentation. Obviously, the scope will start with the obligation to serve, set out the background, the policy theme behind the proposal, the current legal position, and the proposal that we make in the bill. On the establishment of the Defense Force Service Commission, Chair, we will speak again on the background to the issue. What are the policy themes and the legislative proposal that we are taking before the committee? And the same will be done with regard to the issue of the military command. We will just explain where we come from with the concept of the military command and what is it that we seek to achieve and how that command should be appointed. On the obligation to serve, Chair, currently, the members of the Reserve Force, Chair, serve the Department of Defense on a voluntary basis, and they render service in terms of a contract. And the contract will normally stipulate the period that a person is prepared to serve in a given year. Further, the members of the Reserve Force currently have no obligation to report for training, for exercises, for any deployment for peacekeeping purposes. They can only be compelled to serve in time of war, state of emergency, or state of national defense. This, Chair, makes it extremely difficult for defense planners to plan and to allocate resources as the availability of the Reserve Force members is not guaranteed. If the current analysis of the Defense Act as it stands, it is such that nothing makes it compellable for a member of the Reserve Force to render a service, unless he makes himself available. In the circumstances that are short of a wartime, they can only be compelled when there is a war. But for instance, for border patrol, for rendering support to other departments, there is no obligation to serve on their part. Each member must raise his hand and say, I'm available during this particular period. So even if you had wanted to deploy them for a specific purpose, in circumstances short of a war, you have no legal basis to compel them. And that really, Chair, is the mischief that we seek to address with this proposal. We suggest, Chair, that certainty requires that a matter of service in the SANDF should not be left to the whims of an individual, but to legislation. This approach will eliminate any contractual disputes at a later stage. Currently, it is based purely on contract, but a person must be willing to serve at a particular time, not at the instance of the department. It is the DOD's view that Reserve Force members should be obliged to serve during peacetime, e.g. under the following circumstances: where life, health, or property are in imminent danger, to ensure the provision of the essential services, to support any Department of State, including support for purposes of socioeconomic upliftment, and effect national border control. This chair is particularly so given the ever-expanding mandate of the department and the demands on the SANDF. Chair, if you look at the issue of the budget as well, given the fact that the defense budget is ever shrinking, it becomes critical that you have a resource that is a reserve force that you can use at a cheaper cost as compared to regular force. In the bill, therefore, Chair, we propose that it should be compulsory for the members of the reserve force to serve in peacetime when called upon to do so by the SANDF. We further propose the creation of an offense for any member of the Defence Force who failed to honour a call-up. This chair, we need to state it categorically that it does not detract from the rights that the members of the SANDF have under Section 66 of the Defence Act. Now, Section 66 of the Defence Act entitles members, where certain circumstances, personal circumstances, prevent them from rendering service, that they can apply to the exemption board for exemption from service. So in other words, in as much as we create the obligation to serve under certain circumstances, they still retain their rights if there are personal circumstances that prevent a person from serving, for him to make an application to the exemption board for exemption for particular service or deferment of that service to a later stage. So that door will remain open where circumstances prevent members from serving. Chair, I will then proceed to the Defence Force Service Commission. To date, the conditions of service of members of the SANDF are primarily dependent on the determinations made by the Department of Public Service and Administration or negotiated in the Public Service Coordinating Bargaining Council. This over years, Chair, has proven inadequate as it does not take into consideration the uniqueness of the military service. To address this vacuum, the Minister of Defense and the Military Veterans appointed an interim National Defense Force Service Commission to advise and make recommendation on a unique service dispensation outside the ambit of the public service, to advise on the regulatory framework for unique service dispensation, and to investigate and advise on remuneration and conditions of service. Chair, you will remember that last year we had an incident. I think some members may have referred it just in the previous discussion on the 26th of August, where we had an unruly march in Pretoria. And then immediately after that, the minister appointed an interim service condition, I mean service commission, to look at the condition of service within the Defence Force in general terms. Now, one of the functions of that commission was to advise on the general state of conditions within the Defence Force, but to also advise as to the nature of dispensation that the department can put in place to ensure that the needs and the requirements of the Defence Force are attended to timely. Now, that commission, current one, is on the interim. And out of the deliberations and the recommendations of that commission, one proposal was that we need to have a permanent Defence Force Service Commission. That will be a standing commission to advise the minister on all issues of conditions of service. But the interim service commission will continue to function until this bill has been passed by both houses and the permanent commission has been established. In order to attend to service condition of the members, the bill proposes the establishment of an independent Defence Force Service Commission to advise the minister on general conditions of service. Chair, the bill, we do not purport to reflect all the issues that are in the bill, but we're just referring the committee to certain aspects of the bill that we think are critical, like the establishment of the bill. In the bill, Chair, we propose that the minister should appoint commissioners and that he should designate the chairperson and the deputy chairperson. We also prescribe the method of appointment of those committees. You will see, Chair, if I may just refer you to the specific provisions of the bill, starting from 62A, clause 6 of the bill. The method of appointment that we propose is through a nomination committee. Firstly, the minister must put out advertisements or notices in two national newspapers and in the Government Gazette, inviting nominations, then appoint a nomination committee which will screen the application and the nomination, and then the nomination committee makes recommendation to the minister for the appointment of the commissioners. And the purpose for that really is to give it some sense of independence from the administration itself, because there must be a method that recommends to the minister independently of the department itself. In the bill, Chair, we also provide for interventions by the Minister where the Commission has not been able to discharge its functions effectively and efficiently. The Defence Force Service Commission must, however, be afforded an opportunity to make representations prior to a decision being made on the intervention. If the Minister is, however, still not satisfied with the explanation that the Commission may have provided, the Minister may appoint an administrator to handle the business of the Commission or replace the Commission, but she can only do that with the approval of Cabinet. Chair, if I may proceed to the third element of the bill, that is the definition of a military command. Chair, Section 202(1) of the Constitution provides that the President must appoint the military command of the Defence Force. The Constitution, however, Chair, does not define what is the military command that has to be appointed. The Defence Act, again, Chair, also does not provide any guidelines as to who should form the military command and how that military command should function. So the bill proposes that a new provision should be inserted to describe the composition of the military command. In other words, instead of just referring to a command in the Constitution, which is undefined, we're making an attempt within the Defence Act now to define what is this military command, who is the military command, and how that military command should be appointed. The command as proposed shall include the following persons, the Chief of the South African National Defence Force, the Chiefs of Services, that is the Chief of the Army, the Chief of the Navy, the Chief of the Air Force, and the Chief of the South African Medical Aid Services, and it will also include the Chief of Joint Operations, the Chief of Defence Intelligence, Chief of Human Resources, and the Chief of Logistics. The criteria we use to determine the composition is really the command responsibility that each of these officers has in respect of commanding forces on the ground. It is submitted that the imposition of the obligation to serve for reserve force members shall not negate the principle of voluntarism. Chair, maybe I need to explain this issue again. There is often a perception that the concept of voluntarism to join the Defence Force extends beyond the actual act of enlistment. The Defence Force is a voluntary organization to the extent that you cannot be conscripted to join it. You voluntarily decide to be a member of the Defence Force. But once you have enlisted as a member of the Defence Force, you should be at the disposal of the Defence Force. In other words, the Defence Force should be able to use you once you are inside. So the concept of voluntarism ends at the time that a person enlists. Once you are inside, you cannot choose when to serve and when not to serve. We create an obligation for that purpose. But people tend to confuse it with the issue of conscription. The proposed amendment has been carefully crafted so as not to be onerous to the point of discouraging service in the reserve force or to be disruptive of the functioning of the civil society. Again, Chair, a concern has been raised that creating this kind of an obligation may discourage members from joining the reserve force. But the proposal itself has been workshopped with the Reserve Force Council. The Chief of Defence Reserve has been part of that, and it has been well received, Chair. So we're not concerned about any negative effect it may have on the member, more especially in view of the rights they have in terms of Section 66 to apply for exemption and deferment if there are personal circumstances that prevent or that make it impossible for them to serve. The establishment of the Defence Force Service Commission will enhance the relationship between the SANDF and the members. Chair, I just made an example of the unruly march that we had last year, which was really a reflection of the concern that there may be within the Defence Force itself, and we're hoping that by establishing a commission that will look at their conditions of service, we will be able to address some of the needs of the members. We are hoping, Chair, that the establishment of the commission will also facilitate the timeous improvement of conditions of service and create labor peace. And we have already seen those developments since the appointment of the Interim Service Commission. In December, they got a very huge increment, and we are hoping that, again, in the course of the year, there will be other increments. But we are beginning to see the difference between the Defence Force before the commission and after, and the morale. We believe it has an impact on the morale. Chair, lastly, the inclusion of a provision on military command in the Defence Act will bring certainty on this issue and will facilitate the exercise of the President's power in respect of this. Again, on the issue of military command, Chair, there has been instances where recommendations have been made for appointment of people, more especially at the level of a three-star general. And there's been no guidance in law where you will go to the presidency and the presidency will raise questions, why do you want the president to appoint this person in terms of what? So there's always been that gap to say, although the act, the constitution says the president will appoint the command, but the command is not defined anywhere. Now you always have to find the basis, why is it that the president should appoint a particular general while the others are not being appointed? So the definition of military command seeks to create that distinction between those that should be specifically appointed by the president and those that can be appointed by the minister. And the criteria we use, like I indicated, Chair, is the issue of command responsibility. That it should be at a certain level, it must be persons or individuals who have a direct command responsibility with regard to the forces. Chair, I think I will end it there. Those were the three items that we wanted. I don't know if my colleagues will want to add, Chair, with your permission, if there is anything that I may have left out.
Yes, they can add if there's nothing. Honourable members, we can engage with the report. Honourable Gunda, Louis.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Chair, on the question of the shrinking of the budget and the cheapness of the reserve force, can you just explain that again in your presentation?
I will read it. I can start. The members of the reserve force are not full-time employees, are not full-time on call.
Yes.
Therefore, it means that for the time that they're not being called, the department has no obligation to pay. Whereas those people who are regular members of the force are there all the time, and the department has an obligation to pay them on a full-time basis. So that talks to the cheapness. It's not cheapness in terms of cheap labor like in the olden days. So that is what it means. And couple it with the issue of the shrinking budget, it means that by having these facilities where you're not spending on salaries and so on, you are augmenting the budget that is already not meeting the demands of the Defense Force. So it's shrinking in the sense that also there are many demands in the Defense Force and the current budget is not able to fulfill those. So it's shrinking in real terms in that sense, although the budget may be increased maybe on a yearly basis. But in reality, it falls far short of what the department requires.
Yes, the question has been answered. That was the question. But there's something else. While the leadership of the Defense Force are here concerning this bill, there's a question. Let me put a question to you, Chair, when we are alone. Let me leave it.
Okay. Chair, is this proposal not going to put the country at risk? Because, you see, when you're talking a budget that is shrinking and you want to use, I'll use the literal, just indicate that, you know, temporary staff, you know, because that's temporary staff at the end of the day.
Yes.
No. It's like pick and pay using temporary staff. They come in when it's necessary, you know. Is that not risking the security of the country? Because, you see, I'm worried about that type of, I know they might be disciplined, no? But if a person takes almost more than a year not being called up and is doing something else there, are there regular trainings that they go through? Are they, you know, those are the problems, because that might risk the security of the country at the end of the day, you see. You might, in a way, train people to go and start this, you know, I saw some military groups on TV somewhere in your area. Yeah, they called because they want to forcefully be accommodating. Are you not trying to start those particular processes? Who will, not from outside, will be a military risk within the country? You know, I'm just worried as to what is it that you want to do. You see, I agree that there's a problem around finances,
But what is it that you want to do? Because I'm seeing a greater risk than what you're coming up with.
In addition to that, before you ask Louis, you mentioned, you indicated that reserve force members are not permanent. And then how would you compel a person to render services when he is not permanently employed to? Is that not in conflict with the labor laws? Honorable Mzimande.
Yeah, Chair, I think your follow-up and Matila's follow-up raised the matter that I wanted to raise in terms of this obligation imposition that is being created, Chair. But I would like to get details as well, Chair, in terms of they are saying that, for instance, they would... He made an example of property and that kind of service. Now, I'm not too sure what informs that, Chair. Is it because at some point they would want them to come and mend the borders, or they would want to use these reservists to, you know, to help in if there is a big function at a stadium, people are threatening, or some service delivery protest. So we get the background. He said he was going to say more to the background to the issue to that informs the this creation of the obligation, Chair. But also, Chair, is it only this clause, or there would be kind of regulations that spells out, you know, the limitations and perhaps the rights? Because and if in their view now that they are saying that they seem to have consulted with the people involved, with the stakeholders, is there nothing that says that people feel that that they would have a constitutional challenge on the matter, Chair, in terms of the obligation that is being created? Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Bielefeld, Honorable Gunda.
Mr. Chair, from my personal experience is that I think every good defense force in the world has its reservists. For example, more than 50% of the Americans deployed overseas out of their country are part of the reserve forces. The responsibility is of training and of maintenance of people, that is so. But that is, there are very, very good models that you can manage it, so it's not unmanageable. And even a reservist must be a volunteer in his own right. And if you volunteer to go to anything, then you must be committed to do so. I think we have in this country a good history of reservists, and of course we call them different names. It doesn't matter, but the concept, I think, is very sound. It's the only thing that we can afford in South Africa to have a decent defense force is to have reserve forces. And the second thing I would like to say, maybe for example, for one of the questions, for example, if you deploy a battalion somewhere in Africa on a peace mission, then you can, for example, use reservists to come and guard the unit instead of using fighting combat troops to stay behind and do that. In the medical field, it's very excellent to use them as paramedics in the combat units. So I would definitely say that it's a very, very sound bill, and I think we should report it in as it is at this stage, because I don't see any threats in it. Thank you, sir.
Yes, Chair. Only one thing. I really appreciate what Honorable Velagada said and my previous colleagues also. The only concern, and I want the defense force people to listen to us, our only concern is the budget and the training of these people. It's very, very important. Let me put the question to you then. If the budget is shrinking, yet I was at Luwatla last year on our oversight, I've seen things in Luwatla which I never knew was in South Africa. And if that is the case, then you guys that are doing planning and the budget for this defense force
I must say to you guys, you are not doing justice to the defense. Because that thing in Lewatla is of utmost importance to this country. And if we are serious about security, defense, the last time I spoken to the general while we were there, I said to her, this is my cell number. You can phone me, I can give you my email address, you can email me anything, because when we were there, we had seen a lot of things. That's why these questions are coming concerning the budget. We want money now. This is a good thing. On paper, this is a very good thing. Don't make a mistake. It's an excellent thing. It's an excellent bill. But this bill needs a lot of money. Then there are other challenges that the defense of it, especially in Lewatla, that also needs money. So all I'm asking is that, as I said to the general the last time when we went, last year when we were in Lewatla, I said to the general this one thing. I said, General, you must be honest with this committee. Very honest. You want us to support you. You want us to make recommendations into your budget. So you people need to be honest with us. So from my side, and I think from the committee side, we will support the bill, but we need to see, we need to know exactly what it is. Will there be enough training for these guys, this reserve force? Yes, we must have a reserve force. And it's an excellent idea. In order to have peace and security in this country, not only in this country, because South Africa are, like, whether we like the word or not, Nigerians call us, we are big brother. Whether we like it or not, South Africa, the world looks to South Africa for the peace in Africa. And these are the things that we really need to look at. Thank you, Chair.
Hello, Martina.
No, you see, it's good to have a general in the committee. Because there is some advice, but you see, I just want to also understand what the general is saying because of experience. My worry is precisely because of this reservist. That we had Treblange doing his own thing, that we have, you know, because that's where they recruit. Is it? That's where they recruit, that's where they do all these things. Because those people are independent from, I'm not sure as to what disciplines are there in the force. I've never been a military person, you see. And when you see them doing these things, and you talk about the large reservist, I become more worried because, you see, it might be a security risk for the for this country. I've seen reservists in the past. I thought they were good. Even if they were fighting against us in the country, when we were staying here, because they were used to deal with us at some point. And that was the situation, you see. But I'm just saying, post-apartheid, you have seen some of these things happening, you see. I mean, if you take the people that are on trial now, the Boeremans in Pretoria, almost 80% of them are military people. You see? I'm just saying, what risk do we have? Because if it's too large, I'm not worried about, because we must have that. As a country, we must have that. But if you push it to what you're saying, because the budget is shrinking, you need to have a very large one, so that you can tap into that. What risk we have for the country? Because that's where my worry is. And if we can have answers around that specific area, because I don't want us to create other armies that will be an enemy to this particular country. You must also know that this country is not yet stable. You see, there are internal factors within the country that are a challenge to us. And as a defense force, you must be alive to those situations.
Honorable Belfort. Honorable Chair, I just want to make a few comments. The first thing is that I think the time has arrived that we must start believing in our military commanders.
And I don't think they will embark on this kind of thing if there's a threat for the country. Instead, they are doing, if they are doing it for this to be a deterrent to the threat of this country. And I think what you are thinking about, the RVB and all those kind of things, I think it's, they have gone in this country. They will never be a factor anymore, because after 15, 18 years, people made some mindsets. And you must remember one thing. The majority of the people of the pre-apartheid time, they pledged loyalty to this country. And they took this country through the elections, and they was part and parcel of the building up of the country. And maybe I must tell you where I'm coming from. I was appointed in 1995 by Joe Medees as a general officer commanding of the Army Battle School in Luatla. I served there until the end of 1999. I was awarded the Southern Cross decoration by the minister and the president, and I was responsible for the training of all the generals that you see, even Nyanda and all those that came to the Army Battle School to get them together to form a new army of the seven that they used to be. And I think that was a very, very successful exercise, and I believe that the concerns of my colleagues are very, very valid. But I think we must trust the people that we are in command of this, and even the budget will determine the size of this force. And even if you have a reserve force, you don't issue them with weapons and say, go home with the weapons. You mobilize them, you retrain them, you equip them, you call them up for a period of time to complete a job, and that's in a story, and they demobilize until the next time when you need them. And I think it's better to have people in your structures than to have dissidents out of your structures. So then you can still control them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. You can respond. No, to some of
the defense review and the white paper on defense stipulate that the South African National Defense Force will compose of regulars and reserves. And I think it's 55 reserves and 45% regulars, somewhere around there. We are not yet even there. So if the concern is that we are raising the numbers, we are not even at that ratio of 45-55. Because at the dawn of democracy, there were probably about 110,000 serving members. Today, they're down to about 65,000 members. So the difficulty is now, how do you reach the ratio, for instance, of that goal of 45-55? The department had instituted various mechanisms to allow people to go and to recruit even new people as regulars. But the point I'm really making is that the reserve force is part and parcel of how we compose the SNDF. It's not something that is coming now or is a stamp sign. It's a policy that is there of the government. So it is there, and as it is indicated, defense forces throughout the country use reserves, because the issue of shrinking budget shouldn't be brought so much into this, but the point that he was making is that it does offer an opportunity to save some resources and use it for other things. So it's not so much driven by the money, but it's something that is there. And in terms of the people who join, or there's something that we call one force concept. By one force concept, we say, although they are regulars and reserves, but these people are one force, governed by, for instance, the same code of conduct that people sign up for and commit their allegiance to the Constitution and to upholding the law of the country. So those are the people who come in and join in the defense force. So that even if they are not in the employment of the force, they're basically, they've committed themselves to that code of conduct like any other soldier. They are deployed alongside people in other soldiers in Burundi and so on. They are the people who were the backbone of helping the country during the recent public service strike, where the Defense Force took control of about 74 hospitals throughout the country. Some of those people who served there, the bulk of them, came from the reserves. And for somebody who's looking, they were just ordinary soldiers. There was no distinction, but they came from the reserves, the bulk of them. So it's a resource that allows the country not to inflate the numbers of its regular members, while it has a resource of a pool of people that can be called and who are ready to serve or willing to serve. So what the bill creates is that to put an extra net to get people onto serving when they are called upon, because what the bill seeks to achieve is to make sure that people can be called even when it's not times of war, when you have to defend the country. Like, for instance, in times of floods, for instance, the Mozambican floods, it's not war, but can you call the reserves? There was no obligation, there is no obligation now. The bill creates that obligation that the chief, the commander of the armed forces, can be able to call those people even to serve for those kind of circumstances that are not provided for in the current bill. So maybe I'll give to my colleagues to add. But basically what I'm saying is that the reserves are part and parcel of the National Defense Force. They are not an add-on in the sense that it's something that we think, no, the whole Defense Force is designed around regulars and reserves.
Chair, if I may just add, I think Mr. Rasomo has made the point that I wanted to make, but I just feel the need to explain. We're not going on a recruitment drive. We have a reserve component within the Defense Force.
Yeah.
All we are saying is, to what extent is that reserve force component accessible to the department? If you were to have a disaster today, not a war, because you can only force them to serve in time of war, if you were to have the so-called xenophobic attack today, will you be able to access those people? And will those people be available to you to serve? We are saying, in terms of the law as it stands, there is no such an obligation. You are at their mercy. And that is the mischief we're trying to address. We're saying they cannot only be compellable at a time of war. What about all those issues we listed there where life is in danger? It could be a natural disaster. It could be a riot in a township. You need to be able to access them. And that has direct implications to planning and budgeting, because there is nobody who is going to allocate resources to any component that is not guaranteed to be available when it's required to serve. So it has direct implications as to how you resource or you fund the reserve force component itself. But it's not about expanding it. We have a reserve component, but we want it to be accessible to the department when the situation arrives. And I think, like the general said, it is a trend internationally. The reserve forces are seen as a force multiplier. Most forces will find they will have a lean and small regular force, but a bigger reserve force. And the U.S. is one example. If you look at the Iraq, you look at Afghanistan, all those people are reserve force members. So it's not a recruitment drive. We're not expanding it. We're just saying we want to be able to use them when the country needs them. On the issue of constitutionality, Chair, which I think came up, again, I need to explain, Chair. We're not going to force anybody to join the reserve force or to join the defense force. Defense force remains a voluntary force. But once you are enlisted, you are no longer a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
You volunteer to join the force. But once you are inside the force, you must be available to serve the nation. That's what the Defense Force is about. So the issue of constitutionality does not arise. But, Chair, as a further backdoor, in terms of the Defense Act, if today we were to issue a notice for you to serve, to go to the borders up north, and there were personal circumstances that prevent you from doing that, you are entitled, in terms of the Act as it stands, to make an application for exemption or for deferment of that service. So there are mechanisms that are built into the system. It may be that you are running your own business, you think it will suffer, it's a critical time for you to be present. You can apply and say, I need an exemption, or I need my service to be deferred for another 6 months. At that time, I will be able to serve. So there are mechanisms to make sure that it does not become unnecessarily burdensome to the members themselves. So there are mechanisms, Chair. Thank you very much.
I've been satisfied with the answers that I received from. All I would like to say is that we really need to appreciate the men and women who are doing the service. Sometimes we tend to neglect them, and sometimes we tend to turn a blind eye. I'm one of those people that used to pay Aksai
the defense there in Upington. I go there every month twice to check on discipline, to check on the place. I walk in there unattended. I just went there and said to them, I want to see this commander or this. So it's time that I like the bill for one reason or for one purpose only, is that it gives the people the reserves. It makes them, there's an obligation for the reserves now. If there's any other thing in the country that they are needed, their service are needed, they can serve the country. The other only question that was my question, when they you call up the reserves, are they also secured like the permanent staff for their life? Are they also secured? Does this bill make provision for this? Or is there a bill that protected them? You send them to Burundi as a reserve. What happened to his family if anything happened to him in Burundi? Is he secured for that? That's my question. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Matthew.
No, Chair, I hear. I don't have a problem with the bill. I don't have anything. But I think it is important that the legal people must actually clarify the constitutionality of the whole thing, so that when we agree, we don't have any problem, that tomorrow we must come back and say, but constitutionally or legally, these are the flaws. But also ask that the researcher goes deeper into this area and then check as to whether everything is fine and come back to us, indicate to us that we don't have problem in as far as this. If there are issues that has to be raised, let them be raised. And I'm saying both the legal team and our researchers to do that for us, so that when we deal with the bill, we are not told in 6 months' time that, but this was wrong, we think you should have done 1, 2, 3. Okay. Thank you, Chair.
You can respond.
Chair, on the issue of constitutionality, which seems to be of a concern, we have our colleague here from the State Law Advisor. As you will know, Chair, before every bill is introduced in Parliament, it must be certified by the Office of the State Law Advisor. And one of the issues they look at is the issue of constitutionality. So I think maybe it's not fair for the Department to respond to that, because obviously we will say it's constitutional. I think my colleague will have to come in on that. But on the issue of what happens to a member of the reserve force, if something were to happen to him while he's on deployment, I think Mr. Ratomo alluded to the issue of one force concern. That for all intents and purposes, members of the reserve force, while in service, they are treated the same way as a member of the regular force.
Thank you.
For medical, for accidents, for anything,
thank
they are treated the same.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do you want to come in, Mr. Smith?
Chairperson, yes, I can add very little. We have looked at the bill, and it is. We were happy that it is constitutional. Insofar as reserve force members are concerned, they are in actual fact placed, as my colleague just said, placed in the same position as permanent force members, and as permanent force members can be compelled to serve in a case of a disaster. This act will ensure that reserve force members can also be compelled to serve in such instances. So they are put in the same position as permanent force members. So we're happy about the constitutionality of the bill.
Thank you. Any other engagement? In the absence of none, this then brings us to the end of the meeting, but let me take the opportunity to thank the team from the Department of Defense and the State Law Advisor for their brief presentation explanation on issues where we wanted clarity. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sorry, do you maybe have an extra breathing time?